Voice Radio Program.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Please listen to verses 9 to 11 of chapter Hud from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Sayyid Ahmad Mirzadeh Waqifi.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. ولئن أذقنا الإنسان منا رحمة ثم نزعناها ولئن أذقناه نعماء بعد ضراء مسته ليقولن ذهب السيئات عني إنه لفرح فخور إلا الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير. صدق الله العلي.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. And if we make man taste mercy from us, then take it off from him, most surely he is despairing, ungrateful. And if we make him taste a favor after distress has afflicted him, he will certainly say, "The evils are gone away from me." Most surely, he is exulting, boasting. Except those who are patient and do good. They shall have forgiveness and a great reward.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines. Iraq's health ministry says more than 50 people are killed in a fire at a hospital treating COVID-19 patients in the country's south. Venezuela's president Nicolas Maduro says 10 Colombian paramilitaries have been killed in clashes between armed groups and security forces in the capital Caracas. Also, France, Greece, and Spain introduced new coronavirus-related restrictions to contain a new wave of the disease amid a sharp rise in infections. Thank you for joining us. Beginning with our top story, dozens of people have been killed after a fire ripped through a hospital in the southern Iraqi city of Nasiriyah. Isolation ward in Al Hussein Hospital. A medical source said rescue teams are struggling to reach those patients who are still believed to be trapped inside the building. Health sources say the death toll could rise as search operations are ongoing for many missing patients. Initial police reports suggested that an oxygen tank explosion inside the ward was the likely cause of the fire. In April, a fire caused by an oxygen tank explosion at a COVID-19 hospital in the capital of Baghdad killed more than 80 people and injured 110 others. Palestinians have staged a demonstration outside an Israeli prison near the occupied West Bank city of Ramallah, calling for an immediate release of a detainee to attend her daughter's funeral. The protesters chanted slogans in solidarity with Khalida Jarrar, a Palestinian lawmaker serving a prison sentence at the Ofer prison. Palestinian rights organization Al-Haq has sent an urgent appeal to the United Nations calling for her release. Palestinian activists and rights groups have also put up an online petition, but the regime has so far denied the request. Jarar was given a 2-year sentence on alleged charges of inciting violence and belonging to a banned organization. Her 31-year-old daughter was found dead at her home on Sunday from an apparent heart attack. Palestinians in the Gaza Strip hold a protest to express solidarity with those arrested under illegal administrative detention without any charges. The Israeli regime has recently extended the administrative detention for several detainees, including a parliament member who was suffering from weak health condition. Ruba Shabbat reports from Gaza.
Palestinian protesters gathered in front of the Red Cross in the Gaza Strip to voice anger at Israel's extension of administrative detention for several Palestinians, including parliamentarian Mohammed Abu Tair. The protest is organized by Hamas resistance movement in an effort to express solidarity with these prisoners and to condemn Israel's illegal policy.
The administration policy is a desperate means that proves that Israeli occupation is disappointed by the Palestinians' steadfastness in Jerusalem al-Quds. Israel is targeting officials now in order to silence the ongoing protests and the voices of the Palestinians in the West Bank. This administration detention is a clear violation of international law.
Abu Tair has spent more than 35 years of his life in Israeli prisons, being transferred from one detention center to another. He was released from his last arrest in February after spending 11 months under administrative detention. He was arrested again earlier this month. His age and health condition have raised concerns among the Palestinians.
Israel detains Palestinian officials because it's scared of people guiding Palestinians into defending their rights and liberating their lands. That's why Israel is arresting people with no charges. Mohammed Abu Tair spent more than 35 years inside Israeli jails with no charges. The world should break silence and stand by Mohammed Abu Tair, who is old and sick, and all other Palestinian detainees.
During the last 2 months, Israel has increased the administrative detentions against Palestinians. The move is part of Israel's policy of deterrence and controlling the protests against Tel Aviv's atrocities.
This event comes in solidarity with the Palestinian detainee Mohammed Abu Tair, who was detained by Israeli regime with no charge as they referred him to administrative detention. The number of Palestinian detainees under the administrative detention in Israeli jails reached 520 people. We totally reject this inhumane policy. This is a message to the Israeli regime that we won't abandon our detainees who suffer alone inside its jails.
Over the years, Israel has placed thousands of Palestinians in administrative detention, in which the regime keeps the detainees for up to 6 months without charge. This period can be extended an infinite number of times. Women and minors are also among the detainees. Palestinians expressed their rejection of Israel's so-called administrative detention, which they say is in violation of international law. They also urged the international community to hold Israel fully responsible for the life of Abu Tair, who is old and suffers from diseases while in custody. Ruba Shabbat, Gaza.
Iran says its position on Vienna talks aimed at reviving the 2015 Iran nuclear deal has not changed since the beginning of the negotiations, adding that certain issues are still unresolved. The foreign ministry spokesman said a long way has been taken to tackle the issues, but the remaining path is not smooth. Saeed Khatibzadeh noted that Tehran's demands during the talks have been very clear. The United States must first remove all sanctions in a verifiable manner. He stressed that Tehran regards any extra demands beyond the original deal as irrelevant. Meanwhile, Washington said it is ready for a new round of the talks. The U.S. does not participate directly in the negotiations, which have been held 6 times since April. The former British Parliament speaker has become the latest European politician to support an armed terrorist organization bent on overthrowing the Iranian government. John Berko, who joined the MEK's annual gathering in Albania virtually, has been criticized for associating with a terrorist cult behind assassinations and bombings that resulted in the deaths of thousands of Iranians over the past 4 decades. Saeed Purreza reports.
yet another attempt by a banned terrorist organization at rebranding itself as a legitimate opposition group in exile. The Mujahideen Khal organization, known as the MKO, which held its annual gathering in Albania, featuring generously paid politicians and former government officials from the U.S. and Europe, giving carefully worded speeches in person or online. Among them, former British Parliament Speaker John Bercow, the man who recently defected the Conservative Party for Labour after launching a withering attack on his erstwhile party member, Prime Minister Boris Johnson. We reached out to Mr. Bercow's media representative requesting for a clarification regarding his involvement with the MEK. Received an automated response saying they would be in touch shortly. We are yet to hear from them.
I think our politicians need to be careful about how they behave, and that's politicians of all colours. And I think, unfortunately, they're really stretching the bounds of ethics and what it is to be a public servant, which is very unfortunate.
Former politicians speaking at the MEK's annual gatherings is not without precedent. Over the years, the terror cult has splashed out sizable sums of money to enlist the support of people in power on both sides of the Atlantic. Most notably, former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton paid upwards of $40,000 per speech in 2018.
Only three reasons can explain why the former Speaker of the British House of Commons might speak to the MKO. Either he literally doesn't know of the thousands and thousands of people this terrorist organization has killed, or he doesn't care about that, or the money was so tempting that it became more important than any moral objection to the MKO.
The MKO, who used to be based in a large military garrison in Iraq, fought against Iran alongside Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein in the 1980s and provided material and intelligence support in a conflict that lasted 8 long years and left hundreds of thousands dead, injured, or displaced on either side. In 2000, they were designated as a terrorist organization. 12 years later, the U.S. government removed them from a list of terrorist organizations, and in 2013, the terrorist group relocated to a vast and tightly guarded barracks in Albania that few outsiders have ever entered.
Experts say to see former American and European officials support a known terrorist organization in return for money speaks to the double standard exercised by those individuals when it comes to the issue of terrorism. Saeed Puriza, London.
The death toll from last month's building collapse in the U.S. state of Florida has risen to 94 as search teams recover more bodies from the pile of debris. The Miami-Dade County mayor said 83 of the bodies have been identified, adding that 22 people still remain unaccounted for. The 12-story building in the town of Surfside partially collapsed on June the 24th. No survivors have been pulled alive since the first few hours after the collapse. The rest of the still-standing portion of the building was leveled due to the safety concerns. Multiple investigations are underway to ascertain the cause of the incident. A 2018 report had warned about the building's major structural weaknesses. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro says 10 Colombian paramilitaries have died in violent clashes with security forces in the capital, Caracas. Maduro said a number of other paramilitaries had fled, adding searches underway to find them. They said the Colombian paramilitaries had been training what he called criminals and terrorists in Venezuela for months. Caracas blames those criminals for a recent wave of unrest that has taken a toll on civilians. This past Saturday, more than 24 people were killed in clashes between Venezuelan security forces and gangs in Caracas. Bogota says the gangs are linked to its now disbanded Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, known as FARC. China's foreign minister has denounced the weekend's protests as, quote, systemic provocation by U.S.-backed dissidents. Listen.
There was no social outbreak in Cuba yesterday. There were disturbances yesterday caused by a communication operation that had been prepared for a long time, with multi-million dollar resources, laboratories, technological platforms with funds allocated from the United States government.
Rodriguez blamed the protest on a social media campaign that he said intended to destabilize Cuba. He said Washington should listen to the Cuban and American people calling for lifting of decades-long U.S. sanctions on Cuba. Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador also said the U.S. economic embargo on Cuba should be ended. Meanwhile, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken pushed back against Cuban officials' claims of the U.S.-stoked protests. He claimed it would be a grievous mistake for Havana to accuse Washington of any involvement. The weekend protests followed the launch of a humanitarian assistance campaign on social media. Political commentator Gloria Stella LaRiva says the decades-long U.S. embargo on Cuba aims to crush people's determination. She says Washington has taken advantage of the current problems to exert pressure on Cuba. Let's take a listen.
And one doesn't have to go to Cuba to understand that the U.S. government for 60 years has imposed an extremely brutal blockade that has been intensified under the Trump administration by 243 measures, all designed to try to crush the people's will to continue with their socialist project. And therefore, coupled with the problems that all countries are facing with the pandemic, the U.S. has taken advantage under the Biden administration as well to make things so difficult, creating a pressure cooker environment on the island, that's really why many people went into the streets yesterday to complain about shortages in food, about the blackouts that began to occur, electrical blackouts, on June 21.
Brazil's federal police have launched an investigation into President Jair Bolsonaro over his government's alleged irregularities in the purchase of COVID-19 vaccine. The probe was opened at the request of the country's Supreme Court. Federal prosecutors and the Comptroller General's office are also separately investigating the vaccine deal. Allegations of irregularities are surrounding the $316 million deal signed with a Brazilian intermediary in February for 20 million doses of vaccines produced by India's Bharat Biotech. A Senate commission investigating the administration's handling of the pandemic has cited suspicions of overpricing and corruption related to the contract. The president has denied any wrongdoing. The government, however, suspended the contract after reports of irregularities became public. France has introduced mandatory COVID-19 jabs for healthcare staff while other restrictions remain in place to curb the resurgence of the virus in the country.
For care workers and non-medical workers in hospitals, clinics, care homes, homes for handicapped people, for all professionals or volunteers who work in close contact with the elderly or those who are fragile, including at their homes, vaccinations would be made mandatory without waiting.
Macron announced that citizens who opt against vaccination will be barred from several public places and services, including cafes, restaurants, long-distance buses, and medical establishments. The French president also said that restrictions will be tightened further to fight a recent surge in cases. Meanwhile, other countries in Europe, including Spain and Greece, also introduced new restrictions amid rise in infections. Greece has made vaccinations mandatory for certain workers and announced measures to contain the spread of the virus. In Spain, Catalan and Valencia regions have also introduced new restrictions to curb the soaring infection rate. The World Health Organization slams rich countries for considering COVID-19 booster vaccinations while the most vulnerable in other nations were left exposed to the virus. Let's take a listen.
The global gap in vaccine supply is hugely uneven and inequitable. Some countries and regions are actually ordering millions of booster doses before other countries have had supplies to vaccinate their health workers and most vulnerable.
The WHO chief also criticized vaccine manufacturers prioritizing deals for booster third doses rather than first and second shots for the completely unvaccinated healthcare workers and elderly people in poorer nations. Tedros said vaccine nationalism was, quote, prolonging the agony, and greed could be the only explanation for the ongoing vaccine crisis. The remarks come as the total number of people diagnosed with the virus worldwide inches closer to 187 million. COVID-19 has also claimed more than 4 million lives globally since its emergence in late 2019. Well, that's your war news for now.
What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging. And to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless Thou takes it away. and leave no enemy. And leave no enemy unless thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names. In the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is his anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is his good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from thee, O patron of beneficence.
In the limelight.
Criminalizing ecosystem destruction at the highest level could shore up and strengthen the whole edifice of environmental law, supporting all those working to improve regulation and best practice, from frontline activists to academics, scientists, NGOs, and policymakers, says Jojo Mehta writer in an article published under the heading What It Means If Ecocide Becomes an International Crime. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Ecocide means to destroy the environment, but when considered etymologically from the Greek and Latin, it signifies to kill one's home. When we were first able to view and photograph the Earth from space, our planetary perspective changed. Suddenly, home had a whole new meaning. Nowhere, as far as our technology has been able to discern, is there evidence of any planet like Earth. Anywhere else that can sustain life as we know it. In its recent 11,700-year period of climatic stability that is what our planetary home has done, facilitating the spread and technological advance of human civilization, while benefiting many in terms of material comfort, life expectancy, and societal support structures, this advance has increasingly take place within a framework of thought that perceives nature as other, a resource to be exploited or a foe to be conquered. With this perspective, ever since the Industrial Revolution, we have been at first unwittingly, now recklessly and even knowingly disrupting the biological, chemical, and atmospheric systems on whose stable interaction we intimately and profoundly depend. Greenhouse gas emissions are just one part of this story. Bit by bit, with each felled forest, polluted river system, species extinction, oil spill, toxic waste leak, nuclear or mining disaster, we are committing ecocide. Relentlessly and with startling rapidity, we are killing our home, while exacerbating social injustice, racial inequality, and resource conflict along the way. And because the world legal system doesn't treat environmental destruction with the seriousness we are now beginning to understand it warrants, we are doing this with impunity. The word ecocide was first used on the international stage by Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme at the UN Environment Conference in Stockholm in 1972, when he stated that destruction brought about by large-scale use of bulldozers and pesticides is an outrage sometimes described as ecocide which requires urgent international attention. Nearly 50 years later, the world is at last beginning to pay that attention. Last month, an expert panel of top international criminal and environmental lawyers convened by the Stop Ecocide Foundation proposed a legal definition of the term suitable for adoption into Rome Statute of International Criminal Court ICC as a fifth crime alongside genocide, crimes against humanity, war crimes, and the crime of aggression. Responding to the explicit call of climate-vulnerable island nations Vanuatu and Maldives, directly impacted by rising sea levels and heavy tropical storms, such a move would criminalize unlawful or wanton acts committed with knowledge that there is a substantial likelihood of severe and either widespread or long-term damage to the environment being caused by those acts. The warmth of response to this legal definition has been remarkable, sparking articles in over 100 global publications in the first week, from the Financial Times to Der Spiegel, and from Bloomberg to Le Monde. It has also prompted political action. From Bangladesh to the Caribbean, where an amendment to the government's environmental bill includes the newly released definition in full, diplomats and politicians are joining a conversation which already includes EU states such as France and Belgium and has the support of public figures. Since the International Criminal Court's mandate is the prosecution of individuals, the addition of ecocide to the list of crimes considered of most serious concern to the international community as a whole would make key corporate and political actors personally liable to criminal prosecution in any ratifying state should their decision threaten severe and either widespread or long-term environmental damage, thus creating an enforceable deterrent to help prevent finance from flowing to projects that could destroy ecosystems. Nothing concentrates the mind like having one's personal freedom on the line. Moreover, ecocide law may prove to be not just a stick but also a carrot. Setting a criminal parameter will not only steer activity away from hazards, acting as a kind of health and safety law for the planet, but is likely to stimulate innovation and development in a healthy direction in a wide range of economic sectors. Many of the solutions we need to transition to sustainability are already available. Renewable energy, regenerative agriculture, circular economy, but aren't being supported or developed at a scale, while finance continues to flow towards the same old destructive approaches, leaving those who would do the right thing at a disadvantage. Criminalizing ecosystem destruction at the highest level could also shore up and strengthen the whole edifice of environmental law, supporting all those working to improve regulation and best practice, from frontline activists to academics, scientists, NGOs, and policymakers. While it would be naive to believe that establishing this crime would be a silver bullet for all of our environmental woes or even prevent all ecocides, it is difficult to see how our planet's life support systems can be adequately protected. Or indeed, Paris targets and UN Sustainable Development Goals realistically approached without a hard stop intervention of this kind. This year's NDC synthesis report from UNFCCC certainly suggests that we're not doing well without it. Goodwill agreements and raised ambitions are clearly not up to the task. But perhaps the most powerful effect of defining and criminalizing ecocide and an international crime may be that of beginning to shift cultural and moral assumptions. Our understanding of our place in and responsibility towards the natural world is in dire need of a reality check. Calling out and condemning ecocide for what it is may be exactly what is required if we are to begin to transform our relationship with the earth from one of harm to one of harmony. That may be the best way to ensure our children, our children's children, will still be able to call this beautiful planet home.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
They began in the 1960s as an Islamist Marxist student militia against the tyranny of Mohammad Reza Shah of Iran. But when they failed to win the trust of the Iranian nation after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, they turned their guns on the people. Since then, the People's Mujahideen Organization of Iran, known better by its acronym, the MKO or the MEK, has assassinated more than 12,000 civilians over the past four decades. Yet the group has enjoyed full support of the Americans and the Europeans, especially in the past 10 years, amidst tensions between Tehran and the West.
Everyone after five European courts have ruled that the PMOI does not belong to the terrorist list.
When Saddam Hussein staged a bloody war against Iran in September 1980, the MKO seized the opportunity to take revenge against the Iranian nation by joining the enemy camp. The Iraqi dictator offered the group weapons, cash, and a vast military base named Camp Ashraf, near the border with Iran. For almost two decades, under the command of Massoud Rajavi, the MKO staged attacks against civilian and military targets across the border in Iran and helped Saddam Hussein suppress his own domestic enemies. Isolated inside the camp, the MKO became cult-like. A report by the RAND Corporation concluded that the group had many of the typical characteristics of a cult, such as authoritarian control, confiscation of assets, sexual control, including mandatory divorce and celibacy, emotional isolation, forced labor, sleep deprivation, physical abuse, and limited exit options. The MKO fell out of favor after the fall of its godfather in the wake of the US-led invasion of Iraq. It brought the group into direct contact with US officials. The US had designated the MKO as a terrorist group in the late 1990s, but hawks like then-Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld and Vice President Dick Cheney argue that the group should be used as a weapon against Tehran. In the end, the Pentagon unilaterally designated MKO members inside Camp Ashraf as protected persons and guaranteed their security in Iraq. In other words, the US protected a group it also designated as terrorists. As early as May 2003, the New York Times reported that Pentagon hardliners were moving to protect the MEK and perhaps reconstitute it later as a future opposition organization in Iran, somewhat along the lines of the US-supported Iraqi opposition under Ahmad Chalabi that preceded the war in Iraq. Between 2007 and 2012, 7 Iranian nuclear scientists were attacked and 5 were assassinated. In 2012, NBC News reported that the attacks were planned by the Israeli regime and executed by MKO agents inside Iran. It was around this time that the terrorist group began working to rebuild its image in the West by launching a lavish lobbying campaign under the leadership of Mariam Rajavi, as Masoud Rajavi has not been seen since 2003. As a result, in 2009, the UK delisted the MKO as a terror group, and a few years later, in 2012, the Obama administration removed the group from the US terror list and later helped negotiate its relocation to Albania and convinced the country to accept the 2,700 remaining members. However, the move from Iraq to the relative safety of Albania has triggered a wave of defections. The testimony of these recent defectors follows earlier reports from groups such as Human Rights Watch, which reported former members witnessed beatings, verbal and psychological abuse, coerced confessions, threats of execution and torture that in 2 cases led to death. Meanwhile, at the so-called Free Iran Conference that the group stages in Paris each summer, dozens of US and UK representatives openly call for the overthrow of the Islamic Republic and the installation of Mariam Rajavi as the leader of Iran. It is clear that US and UK politicians are not looking for what they call a regime change in Iran, but they are playing a simpler game. In their eyes, backing the MKO is the easiest way to irritate Tehran. As they know, the real power of the terrorist group is hardly more than the assassination of defenseless people. In the words of Paul Pillar, who served in the CIA for 28 years, they are pursuing anything that would disrupt the political order in Iran, so they can cite such an outcome as a supposed victory, no matter what comes afterwards. MKO members in Albania are mostly acting as a cyber army against the Islamic Republic of Iran. According to Mark Owen Jones, an academic who studies political bots on social media, thousands of suspicious Twitter accounts emerged in early 2016 with Iran as their location, which posted in support of the MKO using the hashtags hashtag Iran regime change, hashtag free Iran, and hashtag I stand with Mariam Rajavi. For most of its life in exile, the MKO was financed by Saddam Hussein. After his fall, the group has desperately been looking for a new sponsor, but has always denied it is financed by Saudi Arabia. Yet, when the former Saudi intelligence chief, Prince Turki Al-Faisal, attended the group's 2016 rally in Paris and called for the fall of the Iranian regime, it raised suspicions again about the role of Riyadh as the sponsor of this terrorist group. According to Ervand Ebrahimian, a professor at the City of University of New York, the money definitely comes from the Saudis. There is no one else who could be subsidizing them with this level of finance. In an article published in 2018, Al-Bawaba revealed that 3 tons of gold ingots and 4 suitcases of Rolex watches were given to the MKO by the Saudis when the group was still in Iraq. To sum up, the MKO is the epitome of hypocrisy, the enemy of the people, with the blood of thousands of innocent people on its hands. It seeks to present itself as a group in exile that fights for the freedom of the Iranian people. The group reveals hypocrisy at a higher level, whitewashing this cult of terror to further policies against Tehran. This is a textbook example of hypocrisy by the self-proclaimed champions of democracy.
In the limelight.
The disproportionate impact of COVID-19 had on low-income and non-white Americans, populations that community colleges tend to serve, created a plunge in community college attendance during the pandemic. We now present you an article written by Lauren Aratani under the heading U.S. community colleges see chilling decline in enrollment during pandemic. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. David Ramirez, a student at Pasadena City College in Pasadena, California, struggled with balancing work and classes during the pandemic. David Ramirez, who works at Starbucks, worked at least 30 hours a week in addition to his classes. He wasn't alone. According to the National Student Clearinghouse data released recently, the number of students enrolled in community colleges, local educational establishments that offer two-year courses that are often seen as an affordable stepping stone to higher education, was down 9.5% this past spring, about 476,000 fewer students than in spring of 2020. The fall has experts worried about the long-term impact of the pandemic on the less well-off. During recessions, enrollment at community colleges tends to increase, as those who become unemployed go back to education. But the disproportionate impact COVID-19 had on low-income and non-white Americans, populations that community colleges tend to serve, created a plunge in community college attendance during the pandemic. David Ramirez said, "I didn't really have the option to stay virtual and work from home, so I essentially exposed to this virus every single day. That was a lot to handle on a day-to-day basis and then go home and try to work on schoolwork." He added, "That's the daily experience for students, especially because financial aid for community college doesn't really cover the full cost of attendance. Online classes, especially for science, technology, engineering, and mathematics subjects, were particularly frustrating to manage as the material was difficult to learn virtually." He said, "I imagine a lot of students simply gave up." While overall college attendance dropped 5% or 727,000 students this spring compared with last year, as many students opted out of virtual learning, community colleges saw the steepest declines when compared to four-year institutions and graduate schools. Enrollment at graduate schools actually increased 4.6% compared with last year. The bulk of enrollment drops at community colleges were seen by schools' younger students, aged between 18 and 24. Separate data from the National Student Clearinghouse has shown a 6.8% decline in graduates of the class of 2020 who attended college immediately after high school compared to the class of 2019. This means while students with undergraduate degrees were getting advanced degrees in high numbers, many high school graduates chose not to attend college at all this year. Davis Jenkins, a senior research scholar and research professor at Columbia's Teachers College, said the decline in college enrollment among graduating high school students is chilling. Davis Jenkins said, "Delaying college really diminishes your chance of completing college," adding, "particularly if community college enrollment is declining, you take away the opportunity of college for millions of students." Jenkins noted, "It's going to increase the divide between education have and have-nots. Community college students make up about 40% of all undergraduate students in the country, totaling 8.2 million across over 1,400 community colleges, the majority of which are public institutions. Many students who opt to attend community college over a four-year institution do so because tuition can be thousands of dollars cheaper. Two-thirds of community college students come from families with household incomes of under $50,000 a year, and about 45% are students of color. Low-income Americans were hardest hit by the economic repercussions of COVID-19 compared to middle- and high-income Americans, being more likely to lose their jobs and remain unemployed during the course of the coronavirus pandemic. The toll of the pandemic also disproportionately hits Black and Hispanic Americans, who saw COVID death rates that were at least two times higher than white Americans. In a survey of about 25,000 students, community college students were more likely to cancel all plans for college compared to students enrolled at four-year colleges. They were also more likely to have caught, be concerned about, or care for someone who had the virus and be concerned about the affordability of college. Administrators at Cuyahoga Community College in Cleveland, Ohio, heard similar concerns from students who were busy caring for family or working and did not see the benefit of attending virtual classes. The school saw a 17% decline in enrollment this past school year. Karen Miller, provost and executive vice president of Access, Learning and Success at Cuyahoga Community College in Cleveland, Ohio, said, "They were definitely affected by this, whether it be a family member who might have contracted COVID or somebody in their family lost a job and they had to go to work instead of coming to school." Some students were concerned about inconsistent Wi-Fi or a lack of quiet spaces to study at home. Karen Miller said the community college had started efforts to get students to re-enroll in the fall, calling, emailing, and texting them to let them know that the school will be back with at least 50% of the in-person capacity. Karen Miller said, "We're trying to re-engage them and let them know that we're going to have an on-ground opportunities, more on-ground classes, and open up our service footprint again come August." She added, "We're hopeful that we're going to see students come back this fall."
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 15:20 to 16:20 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz, every day from 19:20 to 20:20 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat, or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
On April 14th, U.S. President Joe Biden announced one of his biggest decisions since he came to office.
I'm now the fourth United States president to preside over American troop presence in Afghanistan. Two Republicans, two Democrats. I will not pass this responsibility onto a fifth.
Biden delivered his address in the White House Treaty Room, where George W. Bush announced the U.S.-led attack on Afghanistan back in 2001.
On them, or we need somebody else to maneuver on them.
On my orders, the United States military has begun strikes against Al-Qaeda terrorist training camps and military installations of the Taliban regime in Afghanistan. These carefully targeted actions are designed to disrupt the use of Afghanistan as a terrorist base of operations and to attack the military capability of the Taliban regime.
Between these two statements lie 20 years of war and terror. The chief U.S. goal was to hunt down Osama bin Laden. The U.S. had determined that bin Laden and his network were responsible for the September 11th attacks. But there was never a clear exit strategy, even after the Americans killed bin Laden in May 2011 in Pakistan. U.S. combat operations officially began in early October 2001 with airstrikes against Al-Qaeda training camps and Taliban military installations. Under pressure from American air power and an anti-Taliban coalition of Afghans and tribal leaders, the Taliban government collapsed in December. The U.S. flatly refused to negotiate with the toppled officials, sowing seeds for new waves of violence and terror. In the words of Afghanistan expert Ibrahim Bahis, once you have overthrown a force that was ruling over the country and replaced it with a disparate group of actors with diverging priorities and capabilities, seems like there really is very little choice other than to engage in some ways to keep the country from falling apart. The war the Americans staged in Afghanistan was, to a great degree, a serious attempt to undo what they had done in the heat of the Cold War. In the early 1980s, the Americans trained, armed, and financed assorted Afghan Arab groups who fought under the umbrella name of Mujahideen against the occupying Soviet forces. The Afghan Arab fighters later transformed into more distinguished groups, such as the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. By the time Soviet forces retreated from the country in 1989, the Taliban had become a powerful group, and by 1996, they held power over roughly three-quarters of Afghanistan. In short, Washington's aim was to tame the creations of its policy that had run amok. But taming the group was easier said than done, costly, bloody, and almost impossible. Brown University's Costs of War project has also estimated that U.S. military expenses in Afghanistan have exceeded $2.26 trillion. According to the UN Assistance Mission to Afghanistan, over the past 12 years, over 111,000 civilians have been killed or injured. Besides the Taliban, international troops have also killed many innocent civilians, especially when attacking villages with fighter jets and drones. The Afghans have had to bear the brunt of Washington's strategic mistakes and miscalculations. At the same time, the resurgent Taliban now control or contest more territory than at any time since the war began, ignoring calls for a ceasefire or at least a reduction in violence.
More than 50 of Afghanistan's 370 districts have fallen since the beginning of May. Most districts have been taken surround provincial capitals.